Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. Today, we are looking at the Ballad of John and Yoko while they follow a new life in New York City. They spend some time in New York City, and we're going to look at that year after they moved in August 1971, which also resulted in the album of the same name. And it's a very fertile and unusual period in their lives, and a very sudden right turn from what they were actually doing at the time.
It is. This is probably the most, is it too controversial to say this is the most creative period of John's life?
Is it creative? It's certainly inspired. He has a certain injection of beliefs or performance, and he's very visible and he's doing a lot.
He's doing a lot of stuff, yes.
He's doing a lot of stuff. The jury might be out on whether the stuff is any good or palatable to a mainstream audience might be the better way of putting it.
Who are we to judge? But then we have a podcast, so we are to judge.
We are judge, jury, judge, Judy, and executioner, as they say. So all of this kind of activity, this kind of chronology, focuses on the album sometime in New York City. So, big overarching question: do you like the album?
I like parts of the album. I think, yes. when it's good, it's very good, and when it's bad, it's absolutely terrible.
Yeah, I think that's as fair as it gets. It has some utterly cringy kind of moments, but it also has some, as you say, there's some bits, yep, that just rock out. And, you know, to kind of go behind the scenes a little bit, we did, you know, when you and me were talking about, you know, episodes and things to talk about on the podcast, we thought sometime in New York City would be a big 50th anniversary box set, because we had seen Plastic Ono Band, we had seen Imagine, we had seen the Give Me Some Truth box. There was a very nice remix of Angela from the album on that box set. Yes. And the plan seemed to be, from a website announcement back in January of 2022, that there is an Ultimate Mixes 2022 box set coming out. And we've talked a little bit about this before, that it seems to be permanently on ice.
Yes, one of our Bow Street Runners was out, fed back some information to say that essentially there was a dispute or a heated debate between the Lennon estate, between Sean on the one hand and the record company on the other, regarding the lead track of the album, whether that should or should not, or could not be included. And my assumption is that led to some sort of standoff, and no sign of a box set yet. And is the website still up? I think the website came down.
The website came down in the middle of summer, around about the time we kind of found out about this. There was a placeholder website, if you went to sometimeinnyc.com, and it was a placeholder website that just had a logo for the album saying 2022 Ultimate Mix is coming soon. And then that just defaulted to the johnlennon.com website sometime around June or July, and it has, yeah, not gone back. You can go onto the Wayback Machine if you want to pull it up and see what it looked like, but it was the exact same kind of front end website that we had when the Plastic Ono Band box was announced. There was a placeholder website that went up in January 2021. So it seemed that we were just in for the same again, and we weren't. And as you say, yeah, the strong bit of information is that it's to do with a song that, for the purposes of this podcast, we will call Woman Is. Is that fair enough? Woman Is.
I think so.
That's probably the best thing to do. And it's the song, it's the word, apparently. It's also a word that's emblazoned on the kind of newsprint cover of the album. So that's probably something that's also up for negotiation.
Well, yes, you think they could move the little sticker? So whenever the album first came out, there's a nude picture of Richard Nixon dancing with a nude Chairman Mao, and they put an
How did they get them to do that? How did they agree to be photographed?
I think I assume they just, you know, some paparazzo at a White House party.
That makes sense. They
covered that up with a sticker, so they could just, it's probably more acceptable to have a naked Chairman Mao now, so you could just move the sticker from one side of the album to the other. I think that's, perhaps get me Sean Lennon on the phone and I'll mediate for a fee.
It is a pity. Yes, it is a pity, because I think this album is one that, you know, a remix and all the attendant paraphernalia of performances around it could make it a fascinating box set, could really rebuild the album's reputation. As I said, the Angela remix on Give Me Some Truth totally changes that song, and it would remove that kind of, you know, studio murk that kind of exists on the album.
Yeah, I think the album is not well regarded for several reasons. It is that sort of journalistic. It's quite dated in the once topical subjects it covers. But yes, it's a very American sound. And yeah, it's not a sound that people had been used to hearing from John Lennon. It's a sound that he moved away from, that sort of raw, American bar band sound, which works spectacularly well on some of the tracks. But I think the remix of Angela in particular was spectacular. I mean, I was fascinated to see what they were going to do, what was going to turn up from the album on the Give Me Some Truth box, and they did a fantastic job. And as you say, there are demos, there are live performances, there are TV shows, there's full concert performances around this period. It would be a fantastic box set.
Yeah, like John never toured, but this is the closest we get to a John Lennon album that went on the road or got played live. There's a lot of live music attached to that, including the one-to-one gigs, which we'll talk about later on. But, you know, and there's TV performances, there's David Frost shows, all that kind of stuff. If you were to actually get all that into the package, yeah, I think this album would be one for the ages. But I think the issue that people had with the album is, if you kind of look at early 70s solo Beatles, George did well out of the traps, and John and Ringo did well out of the traps, because they kind of did what the audience expected of them. Paul faltered a little bit because he didn't do exactly what the audience expected of him. And this album might be the first time John doesn't give the audience what they want. Plus, it's also the first album where Yoko is front and centre as well. You could have parked Yoko when she was putting out her Plastic Ono Band or her Fly album alongside Imagine. But now it's John and Yoko together. And I think those two things wound people up a little bit.
Yes, I think that's not regarded as acceptable. You know, it's acceptable if Yoko's doing her own album in parallel, but putting them together. And again, you think, well, that similar feeling when Double Fantasy came out, that, oh, it would have been, you know, why this, and why do it that way? We want to hear John Lennon.
Yes.
But yeah, I think you're right. I think he's confounding expectations at this point.
So let's look at the story, look at the timeline. In a wonderful bit of, what would you say, I don't know, cosmic alignment, John moves to New York on the 31st of August 1971, and 1 year later, on the 31st of August 72, he's doing his Madison Square Garden one-to-one concerts. So it's a 12-month period where he totally changes what he's about and how he, you know, he himself and Yoko tether themselves to New York City, and become identified and synonymous with the city. And they are certainly, in that first year that they are there, they are living in a very different way to the way they are living in 1980, to put it mildly. It's a totally different type of existence. But they leave, they move and leave on the 31st of August, 71, a Tuesday. Thanks for pointing that out. And it's initially a custody battle that they go to they go away for, isn't it?
It is. So Yoko has a daughter by her second husband, Tony Cox. And when she divorced Tony Cox, the divorce was finalized in the British Virgin Islands. The British Virgin Islands courts gave Yoko custody of her daughter, but the daughter has remained with Tony Cox. So they are there to try and chase Tony Cox down, because the word is he's moved from the British Virgin Islands and he's now living in America. So the first idea is that they will go to America to find and get custody of Kyoko. there have been other things that we touched on before where they tried to sort of, in inverted commas, kidnap Kyoko from a crash in Majorca, as you do. So there is a background to this. There is an antipathy here, and there is a background to this. So it seems initially to be a temporary thing, and their first day is they move into the St. Regis Hotel, which we've mentioned before in previous episodes.
And you say they're temporary thing. We don't really know their intent as to whether they are ever going to go back to the UK or whether this is intended to be a permanent move. I think the assumption is it wasn't. Nothing was permanent really in their lives at the time.
I think that's a fair comment, that nothing is permanent. It becomes permanent because of the immigration status. If he leaves the country, he can't get back in. If he leaves the country and can't get back in, they can't continue to pursue the custody battle for Kyoko. So circumstances, I think, just conspire to make it permanent, but I don't think there's a sense I am moving to the States, or I am moving to New York and I will never be back, or I am going to make New York my home. You know, because it's quite a radical shift. They've been living in Tittenhurst, they move from Rockstar Mansion to hotel, and then ultimately they end up back in the Dakota. But I don't think it's a permanent intention is there at the time.
But it is strange, as you say, that they, Tittenhurst Park, another kind of place that's synonymous with them. They've only been in there for 2 years. They moved in August 69, August 71. They basically walk away and they never set foot in Tittenhurst Park or the UK ever again. And at that point, the Imagine album isn't even out. That's not due out until September 71. So by the time Imagine comes out, they are never going to be in Tittenhurst ever again. It's so strange and final. But as you say, they initially move into the St. Regis Hotel. They've got three rooms there. And August 1971, it's the same month that George has done the concert for Bangladesh, just to get people's timelines in order. So August the 1st, he does his concerts for Bangladesh in Madison Square Garden. And a month later, John and Yoko are living in New York. And in a way that they weren't quite as accessible in the UK, although they did do lots of interviews, but they basically opened the door straight away and say, we're in a hotel, come and interview us and chat to us and we'll tell you what you want to know. They kind of get stuck in.
Yes, they're very accessible. So they take three rooms in the St. Regis Hotel and they effectively hold court there. You know, we've talked before about interviews with Ray Connolly that they do there. They're filming some of their art pieces there, making films. This process of documenting their lives that begins really, I suppose, with Two Virgins and Ballad of John and Yoko and all the film footage around Tittenhurst, this continues. And it's interesting that you mentioned Bangladesh, and they've stepped into that. One of the interviews that they give is very anti-George.
Yeah.
And you do have a sense that George has sort of upstaged John with Bangladesh. George is king of the world at this point, and he is sort of putting the sloganeering of power to the people and give peace a chance, and that John does so well. George has sort of put this into concrete action, delivered this concert, and George is being feted as the number one Beatle with All Things Must Pass, the concert for Bangladesh and all the rest of it. And they some of the comments they say about George, that he's very narrow-minded. Yoko says, not sophisticated intellectually, and very trendy, has all the right clothes, which I imagine is John's ultimate put down.
Well, you have to wonder if some of this is also the personal layering in, if the story is true that John was invited to Bangladesh on the reason that he did not bring Yoko, that, they're just getting the knife in, that John's choosing a side. There's potentially a bit of that as well. But George is still in their orbit. He's still there.
He is. So 6th of September, George is hanging out in the hotel, and they're the Imagine film, if you remember, George walks in with Yoko and Fred Astaire is there, who insisted on doing his pit several times to get the tick exactly right. So despite this, George is still in their orbit and happy to turn up and squire Yoko around the hotel room.
And Dick Cavett is also in that Imagine film. He's another one of those people there. And John is, and Yoko are appearing on the Dick Cavett show that same week. Dick Cavett is, he's still a fascinating man. He was kind of a New York liberal intellectual who had this fantastic talk show in the early 70s. He's still very active on Twitter, very proud of the kind of conversations that he was leading at the time.
Yeah, well, it'd be great to get, you know, if Dick Cavett is listening, he definitely get Dick Cavett on, have a chat with him.
Yes.
Because it's a completely different style of talk show to what we're used to now, where people are just coming on, plugging their album. You know, Dick Cavett is having long, in-depth, serious political conversations with people. And it's a very leisurely unfolding, and that would be great. There's a fun fact about that. There's a fun fact. Do the fun fact.
The fun fact. This is the clip that's used in Forrest Gump when Forrest Gump is on the talk show with John and Yoko. The other fun fact I'll tell you about Dick Cavett is, you know, the Randy Newman song Rednecks. So the last night I saw Lester Maddox on TV. The TV show they're talking about is the Dick Cavett show, where Lester Maddox where Lester Maddox is made fun of by this kind of elitist New York audience, and he gets into a tough huff and wanders off. And so Randy Newman put that into his song Rednecks, which also features a word that that we are avoiding today as well, that song. Anyway, so they hit the ground running in September 1971. They're in the St. Regis Hotel. They are doing experimental movies. Which one are they doing this time?
Clock.
What's Clock about? Do we know? It's probably
it's about a clock. It's about a clock. There is a clock ticking on the mantelshelf, as Ringo would say, and they're just moving around the hotel. I mean, seriously, it's just you set a camera up in the hotel room and there's a clock ticking, and there are some songs and John's playing acoustic guitar, and but it's incredibly self-indulgent.
I am shocked to hear that. Really? That's never been said before. The other thing that's interesting at this point in time is May Pang is around as well. It's worth noting that she goes on to play a bigger role. But once they land in New York, is it that May Pang is based in New York working for APCO, and she kind of becomes the de facto kind of a PA for John and Yoko?
Yes. So she starts off as a sort of song plugger, trying to get people to record songs that for which her employers own the publishing. But then in 1970, she began to work as the receptionist at ABCO. She's asked to help. I imagine if you were there as a receptionist, you said, John and Yoko are doing this film. It's called Up Your Legs Forever. Could you get involved? I mean, anyway, she throws herself into
gets
the task.
Involved.
Gets involved. That was sort of in December 1970. And then eventually she's sort of asked to be John and Yoko's secretary or general gopher, I suppose. And then she becomes their permanent personal assistant.
You can just park that piece of knowledge there, knowing what eventually happens. One of the big things that happens is that Yoko has an art exhibition in Syracuse in upstate New York. And this is a big deal.
This is a big deal. This is a big deal for her. This is also a big deal for Paul. If you remember, we talked about this in his 2018 GQ interview, and he's talking about Alan Klein. He said, Alan Klein arrived and promised he'd make us millions and he'd give Yoko an exhibition at the Everson Museum in Syracuse, New York. And you think, no, he couldn't possibly have thought that back in 1969. But yes, this is Yoko getting a big, prestigious art exhibition. It has always been one of Klein's major selling points. I will get this. Organize this for you. And essentially it's a retrospective going back 10 years, a show of unfinished paintings and sculpture.
Yeah, and it's a big deal. It is, there's actually some YouTube footage of some of the performances from it, a thing called Free Time, which was not broadcast until the following May, is a kind of a recording made at Syracuse in October 1971, which features John and Yoko doing, it features all that kind of experimental stuff that if you were a satirist or somebody, it's like all that, it's that thing that people think of. It's like, I'm a cloud in a bucket or whatever it is. That it's all there in this Free Time show on YouTube, and John is a full on participant. Like it's actually wonderful to see in a way, because it's her show, and he is the subject for her to do whatever kind of art piece that she's involved in at this time.
Yes, I mean, this is her show. And the one thing I like is there was a room devoted to water pieces. And it was all done fairly short notice. So she has to sort of get things to fill the rooms that she's been given. And she asked various people to donate things, and Phil Spector donate something. And John produces a small fish tank containing a pink sponge. And he called it Napoleon's bladder. That's a Goons reference to me. That sounds very like a Goons, you like Napoleon.
Oh, really? Now you're the Goons expert. Can you place it?
Napoleon's piano is an episode of the Goon Show, and but I just think Napoleon's bladder. I can hear, you know, them doing that in a peculiar Goons voice, which I shall not attempt.
This is the, of course, in the middle of October, 9th of October is John Lennon's birthday, and the previous year on John Lennon's birthday is the middle of recording Plastic Ono Band, where George Harrison comes in and plays It's Johnny's Birthday. Amazingly, how much happens in a year. 1 year later, they're in the middle of Syracuse. There's still supposed to be a John Lennon birthday party with Beatles involved.
The director of the Everson Museum has this wonderful idea and gets his assistant, David Ross, to start pulling together equipment and setting up a stage, basically, for a secret midnight concert with three of the Beatles at the theatre, which is part of the Everson Museum. So this is a Beatles reunion. This is the first Beatles reunion post Bangladesh, you know, where that could have been a possible reunion. So this is the second one. Paul declines the invitation. George Harrison can't make it. So Ringo is there for the exhibition. Phil Spector's there. Eric Clapton, Jim Keltner, Nicky Hopkins, Klaus Voormann, all the usual suspects. But the secret gets out, and it's cancelled because people are, you know, milling around. So they all go back to a hotel room and have a bit of a jam instead.
And this is John's 31st birthday. Just to remember how young he was at the time. Good old Ringo for turning up. It is, I don't know what adjective you would use to say that, to think if you couldn't get the Beatles together for a massive spectacular like Bangladesh, they'll definitely turn up to a small provincial theatre for a Yoko art exhibition.
Yes, it seems logical.
It seems totally logical. The thing I did not know until we were getting ready to discuss this was that there is some footage around of John Lennon's 31st birthday party in October 1971 in a Syracuse hotel room. That nothing is secret anymore. You can actually see what they were doing. And I have to admit, it looks boring.
It looks very, yes. It's not a party. It's not a party I think I would necessarily have wanted to be there, except to say I'd been in a room with these people. But
like, it just looks like a student party. People sitting around.
It is.
In very mundane casual clothes. There's a guitar. There's some bootleg sound footage of them riffing on songs, and they're kind of going through the old standards.
Yeah, but you've got John and Yoko, Klaus Voormann, Jim Keltner, Mal is there, good old Mal, Neil Aspinall, Mal, Eric Clapton, Ringo Starr, Allen Ginsberg, and they sort of run through, I mean, on top of Old Smokey, Goodnight Irene, Take This Hammer, he's got the whole world in his hands, Twist and Shout, La Bamba, Bring It On Home to Me, Yesterday, Yellow Submarine, Tandoori Chicken, you know that song, Tandoori Chicken? George Harrison, Phil Spector co-write.
Oh, yeah, it's a Ronnie Spector song.
Yes, and she says, you know, I'm one of the very few people to have had all four of the Beatles play on one of my songs. And I think she's sort of conflating. She seems to think that all of the Beatles performed on this, but it was actually George and Ringo. And I think she must be thinking, oh, yeah, but John sang that once. Or anyway. Oh, yes,
maybe.
It's very strange. But interestingly, they do Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, and My Sweet Lord.
Well, these are the songs that are in the ether. Obviously, Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey had been a number one single that summer in the US of A, so it was unavoidable. And obviously, My Sweet Lord is the song of the times, and Imagine is about to hit the charts.
Yes, but for all that, the highlight is undoubtedly Allen Ginsberg reciting William Blake's Nurse's Song.
great. All together now, everybody. I don't know Nurse's Song. I'm sure it's not much fun.
I can't imagine it's a toe tapper.
Apparently, there might also be early versions of Attica State being grooved on or being jammed on at this time.
Yes,
so just
yes.
Park that for the Sometime in New York City album. And yeah, you can look all this up on YouTube. It's amusingly mundane. And John sends Ringo a postcard afterwards to confirm. Shall I read this out? Dear hello, Ringo, and Maureen. Thanks a lot for coming to my birthday, Chaos. Looks like some good things will come from the museum show too. Lots of love to you and yours from Bonnie, John and Yogurt. Hello, Maureen, Mrs. Lennon and her husband. That's very sweet that they're still
sending very
each
sweet.
Other postcards.
And they went to some, they kind of made a little collage on the postcard and using an old, you can see it in Ringo's book, Postcards from the Boys. But you think if you were the postman, and you saw
you'd
that.
Pocket that,
you
wouldn't
just
you?
Pocket that. You just pocket that. I'm amazed. Well done, Royal Mail, or the U.S. Postal Service, for not stealing the postcards that were whizzing back and forward around this time.
The other thing that happens in October is, you know, the Regis Hotel is no place to plan a revolution or whatever it is they want to do. So they actually do find their first permanent residence in New York, which is. Not the Upper West Side where they end up, but down in Greenwich Village.
In Greenwich Village, 105 Bank Street. And the fun fact here is their landlord was Joe Butler. Joe Butler, the drummer from The Loving Spoonful.
You've got to have a pension plan.
I was going to say branched out into property investment. Good old Joe.
Yep.
So yeah, there are some great photographs of this and it seems very tiny and they're just sort of living in a bed, on a bed. There's a spiral staircase that goes up to a roof garden and John always made great play of the fact that they were able to just wander around and nobody bugged them and nobody hassled them and all was well. And when I say nobody bugged them, obviously the FBI were trying to bug them. But,
I see what you did there. Yes, they were trying to bug them. Well, it is around this time that the FBI start to take an interest in John and Yoko and... You know, it is October 1971 and leading the FBI is still J. Edgar Hoover. The FBI had been started in 1935. He is currently 71 years of age at this time, J. Edgar Hoover, and he decides that John and Yoko need to have a file opened on them.
Was he still wearing dresses at this point, J. Edgar Hoover?
This can neither be confirmed nor denied, but it does seem like you kind of think that the gap from 1935 when he became FBI head to 1971 seems like a huge gap or a huge chasm in time and change.
It's a lifetime. It's an absolute lifetime. And you think he's bringing the values of 1935 to 1971.
And like comparatively, it'd be like somebody running the FBI today who had started running the FBI in 1985. That seems less like a long period of time, but maybe I'm totally wrong.
It does. Well, if you think about the changes in women's fashion and corsetry between 1935 and 1971.
I think about that a lot.
J. Edgar was, you know, his corsetry and political opinions and views had not moved with the times. I don't think he's no longer with us. He can't sue me for that.
But apparently the FBI couldn't really, they thought that the St. Regis Hotel was at 150 Bank Street, Greenwich Village. So they couldn't really get it lined up correctly.
It's an absolute, for all of the sort of serious undertones of kind of the secret police state, the incompetence of the FBI, not, you know, St. Regis Hotel at 105 Bank Street. And no one sort of, so they're running up and down Bank Street looking for a swanky hotel, not an apartment. I mean, it is crazy. And that's the sort of thing that will recur time and again, that the FBI, incompetence. But they were, they're burgled at one night, one point.
Well, that's the thing, you know, it's John and Yoko kind of have a thing of liking to be very open to the world, but then a former tenant bursts in one night and just starts taking stuff.
Yes. So artwork, TV, Lennon's wallet, but also his address book. And again, you think that's such a quaint idea that you have everybody's number written in a book. You know, in 2022, that seems ludicrous. Well, you just keep it in the cloud, wouldn't you? And so he had to put the word out on the street to say I need my address book, back. I don't have Ringo's number. How am I going to get in touch with Paul? And he says, you know, if this doesn't come back, I'm gonna put the Black Panthers on the case. Which again, yeah. John.
It's a very, so, very 1971 phrase.
It is returned to them. And they stay there until early 1973 when they move to the Dakota.
And there's lots of people visiting them there. So if the people, they're in the milieu of people like Jerry Rubin, Allen Ginsberg, Peter Boyle, the actor, who's also an activist, and Bobby Seale from the Black Panthers. So they're running this kind of open house. It's a very... it's of a certain ilk. There's not people
ilk.
From the Nixon campaign visiting as well.
It definitely isn't. And I mean, I like to think they moved to the St. Regis Hotel just to try and... Allen Ginsberg knows where we are. We should move. But then he'd be around here reciting William Blake again. So yeah. So they're hanging out with these people, these Shakers and Movers in New York. And this is where I really think. The sort of attack, they start to embed themselves in New York through these people.
And moving on to October, John still giving interviews. So the David Wigg interview from the Beatles tape LP is 25th of October, 71. And then they make their first recording, their first New York City recording, which I think is kind of a border between everything that came before and everything that kind of comes afterwards. And the song they record in New York is?
Happy Christmas, War is Over.
Yeah, and, you know, Imagine has come out in previous weeks, so it's kind of going up the charts, the Imagine album and song. This is the kind of the first thing they record after that, and depending on how you look at, you know, I think sometimes Happy Christmas, War is Over, it sits kind of in the Imagine side of things, not in the Sometime in New York City side of things.
I think that's right. It follows the Imagine song, I think. It's part of that sloganeering, everybody... good time, feeling good. But actually, there's a side to the song. At the beginning, they say, you know, Happy Christmas, Julian, Happy Christmas, Kyoko. They just kind of whisper this. And sometimes that's cut off in some of the versions that it appears on in various mixes. But again, it just brings home, it is the background to this is they're still trying to find Yoko's Yoko's daughter. But it is an American production, and it does have a slightly different sound. For all that Phil Spector has previously been involved with Plastic Ono Band and Imagine, this is different. And I don't know whether it's a different studio, the fact that they've got sort of a choir in or what have you, but there is a slightly different sound to it. And I think you're right, it is a sort of transitional song between Plastic Ono Band, Imagine, and then Sometime in New York City on the other side. And I like Yoko's B-side, Listen, the Wind is Falling. Listen, the Snow is Falling.
That's great too. And I think, it Happy Christmas, the tune is obviously lifted from Stewball, the classic composition, Trad R, about a racehorse, which is something I didn't realize till a few years ago. And when you hear Stewball, you think this is quite amusing that John has just lifted this tune, Lock, Stock and Barrel, into this standard.
Yeah, so there's a couple of different arrangements of that song. There's the Hollies, I think, do a version, or there's Joan Baez does a version. But it's such an obvious lift. I'm surprised that nobody called him out at the time, but I suppose Mr. Tradar was no longer around to sue.
Mr. Tradar is not signed up to Alan Klein or anybody similar, so you can just do whatever you want with Tradar. But yeah, I think Happy Christmas kind of is that balance between a pop song, Imagine, versus a message song, a near hectoring song. It kind of gets that balance just right. So it does kind of work as seeing how John was expressing himself at this point in time. And as we will see, Happy Christmas, War is Over, it does get rush released in the US. It does not reach, it does not get a release in 1971 for Christmas 1971 in the UK. It doesn't come out till Christmas 1972 for ATV, Lou Grade, all sorts of reasons, time pressures and all the rest.
Yes, there's particularly the publishing dispute. So this is, again, suddenly Paul is writing with Linda, John is writing with Yoko, 50% of the royalties are not going anywhere near Northern Songs ATV, and this leads to litigation.
Did you mention Paul, as in Paul McCartney?
Yes, we haven't mentioned Paul really, but yes, Paul is...
Paul, what's he up to?
Paul is giving interviews, and in November Paul gives an interview to Melody Maker, and this is a one day we'll just do an episode where we just read out the
this does read like a radio play.
It really does. So basically, Paul sits down. He recorded an interview on the 11th of November 1971 with Chris Charlesworth. Basically, the interview is about Alan Klein, about the publishing, about you know the tax, about how to break up the Beatles, and about Bangladesh. And you know, I've kind of got the notes here of the interview. It goes on pages and pages and pages. But basically, it's all, you know, Paul saying, John is constantly saying, oh, Alan Klein is great. He got George to number one. Look at the Bangladesh concert. You know, you can have this, you can have that. And there's a great quote, and it's that Paul says, and the thing is, of course, you know that when you've got a daddy, it's nice. If you're a little bit sort of worried as to what to do next, and your daddy says, what are you worried about? Hey, John, what do you want, son? Do you want a house? You've got it. And it absolutely skewers John's daddy fixation, the Epstein, Maharishi, Klein. You know, it's a remarkably personal attack on John. And it's not just, you know, John is a terrible person. It's absolutely skewering the heart of John's insecurities.
It is brutal. And, you know, the vogue at the time in the music press was maybe to have longer, very open, very truthful interview styles. And there's parts of this that kind of, you know, Paul certainly would never do an interview like this today.
No.
And he's giving it some, you know, John Lennon and Rolling Stone kind of vibes, where he's letting his mouth fly and saying how he really feels. But it is part of it. Yeah, it is brutal in parts. And, you know, there's some really telling words, you know. You know, there's one bit where he's saying, you know, Klein told the other three Beatles, I'm trying to get control of the company, Apple and everything. Klein keeps saying, Paul's trying to get the song publishing and all those kind of little red herrings everywhere. Now, there is a version of events, as we have discussed before, where you could argue Paul was trying to get the song publishing. But, you know, I do believe that Paul was working for the greater good. But then he goes on to say, you know, I happen to know that the Eastmans are just more moral than Klein. And that's quite a word. That obviously is something that's really important to him. I think you could argue that John and George, maybe to a lesser degree Ringo, don't mind having a, for want of a better term, a bastard in their corner. But Paul actually believes that that's not the way to get things done. And to use a word like moral and morality and all that kind of stuff is very telling.
Yes, I mean, this is, I think, a very revealing interview. And he veers between, you know, saying that kind of comment about John, and then he says, you know, my problem is I'm just not forthright enough. I just don't really say what I think, and I should just say what I think. But he's just skewered John. And then he talks about the Eastmans are just more moral. And then he goes on to explain what he means by that, which is, you know, the Eastmans just get paid a fee. They don't bother with other fees, just pay a fee. I just pay a fee because I don't like having everything in a sack. I'm not into them for anything. So it then swings back to this idea that, a lot, you know, Paul and money and not wanting to pay, and why not take 15% and querying what Epstein was going to take. And that, so it's very revealing. And he goes right back and reviews the Northern Songs issues and the first meetings and all the rest of it. Then he said, you know, John said, you know, Klein says, I'm going to make the Beatles bigger than they've ever been. But all I have to say, as far as I'm concerned, he's never really come up with that. But he did, Paul. We did this before. He kind of, you know, increased your income exponentially. And then he talks about Bangladesh and said, I might easily have done it. I might have done it. The fact of the matter is Klein was in there. And the reason why I couldn't do it was because if I go do it, then I'm supporting Klein. He's organizing the contract. And all he has to do is put a little picture with the Beatles in Billboard next week, you know. So it is impossible to think of him doing this kind of interview now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very striking. And he's what you kind of see from Paul here is he's keeping receipts. He's remembering what's happened. And he certainly has a very kind of strong memory of what's gone down in 1969. I can't imagine John or George, well, obviously they would have a different side to the story, but I don't know would they be as lucid on some of the fine print or the details as Paul kind of shows himself to be here.
He is across a lot of that, but one of the things you have to remember about this interview is he knows this interview is going to be in the paper. Everybody at this stage is trying to win a PR battle. Paul in particular, I think, knows he is on the wrong side of public opinion. He is being cast as the guy who broke up the Beatles. And whilst he does recount a lot of the detail, you know, some of it has a little bit of a spin to it. So,
oh yeah, he definitely has a side.
And yeah, I mean, he talks about the Let It Be album, and he said, I was told to sign a new contract just after we've been told we're not going to play together again. And I said, well, isn't that a bit silly? And Klein said, it doesn't make any difference. You get a new royalty. If you don't do any more stuff, you still get more royalties than you've made ever. Now, what I didn't realize was, yeah, that was all true, but you'd have to sign yourself up again. But he did sign up. He did sign the contract
in September 69. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's you can see him sort of swinging back and forward in this interview, and a lot of it is clearly written knowing that John will read it. This is a point where Paul and John really are just using the music press to communicate. There seems to be no communication directly between the two of them, and they're just batting letters back and forward and giving interviews back and forward. The music press must have loved this.
Well, yeah, it sells a lot of papers. I mean, John does read it, and he does fire off a letter to Melody Maker on November the 24th, 71, which is published in the Melody Maker of December the 4th, 71.
Yeah.
The main letter doesn't seem to exist anymore. It seems to have been edited for publication, but John is livid, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, Melody Maker's editors write back to him and say, we're taking some of this, we can't publish this. 9 lines of the letter are excised for publication. So we don't know what was in there, but we do have a reply. You know, so Melody Maker write to John and say, we're editing this. And then he writes back to Melody Maker in response to that letter. But the original letter is lost. And Hunter Davies tried to find the correspondence in 2012 for his book, The John Lennon Letters, but it couldn't be found. But he writes, John replies saying, you may be interested to know that Lou Grade in Northern Songs is preventing Happy Christmas, back with Listen, the Snow is Falling, coming out in England at all. It will be released everywhere else in the world but England. It's a fucking shame. P.S. What was libel about saying Paul was camp? PPS, the letter was done very tastefully. Thank you, John and Yoko. And you think, what did he say?
He called Paul camp, which is an odd, that might have been a bit of a code at the time, or a slur at the time. It's doing neither of them any favours. And, you know, do you want to pick a fight with John Lennon in public? Really?
This is the thing.
You know, he's gonna, and I think, fight dirty.
Yeah, and I think they realize this, because this is, we talked about this on the Ram episode. So this is around the time when they will meet and they will decide and agree to stop the public,
yes,
sort of recriminations in the backward and forward. So that will stop around this point.
So we're still coming in towards the end of 1971. The Raga film is premiered in November 23rd. George is involved in that film with Ravi Shankar. And George says John and Yoko are at the premiere. We're not really sure whether that's true or not.
I'm not sure that that's true or not. I don't know.
And then, as we said, Happy Christmas, War's Over with Listen to the Snow is Falling comes out on the 1st of December in the US. But it's also at this point in time that the network that John has been putting around himself since he arrived in New York on the 31st of August start to pull kind of John into this orbit of events that will more directly inform the topics and the tone of the album, the eventual album, sometime in New York City.
End of part one. Intermission.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just 15 bucks a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
End of intermission. Part two.
Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman decide that they're going to get John to appear at a rally for John Sinclair. What's the story of John Sinclair?
Story
as
of
if, well, as you, if you, the story hasn't told us.
you just need to listen to listen to the song. So essentially, he is a poet, a writer, political activist. He's from Flint, Michigan. He's making a name for himself as a poet in the mid-60s, but then he takes on the role of manager for the MC5.
Yeah, Kick Out the Jams.
Kick Out the Jams, mothers, brothers, and sisters. This is going to be very problematic. Have you ever heard a very explicit podcast. Have you heard that album? There's two versions of that album where they kick out the jams, brothers and sisters, and they very bad at it. Anyway, so 1968, he's still working with the MC5. He serves as a founding member of the White Panther Party, an anti-racist sort of left-wing group, counterpart of the Black Panthers. He is arrested for possession of marijuana in 1969. He has two joints in his possession, and he is sentenced to 10 years in prison.
And they gave him 10 for two. That's about it.
That's exactly it. Oh, it's like having John Lennon in the room.
It was just great, beautiful.
This becomes a kind of cause celebre and a kind of focus for protest. And perhaps most famously, apart from the song, Abby Hoffman jumps on stage at Woodstock with The Who. And this is if you have the Who box set,
30 years of Maximum R&B. Okay. This starts the box set.
You hear Hoffman kind of shout something, and before he gets clobbered by Pete Townsend to get off my stage. So
it's very funny. While John Sinclair is rotting in prison, and you just hear Pete Townsend go, "Get off my effing stage," clang, and he's thrown forward off the lip of the stage. It is amusing.
Here we can sit here in our, 21st century where, thought of getting 10 years in prison for marijuana is just ridiculous.
We live in such
liberal times.
It's worth saying that John Sinclair is still alive. He lives in Amsterdam. He's 81 years of age, and
it's a good ad for marijuana.
A long life with marijuana. And in the last month, there's been a presidential edict in the US to decriminalize and give amnesty to people with similar convictions, which is a curious evolution of the times, we would say. There's this high profile protest, and it's, as we said, Jerry Rubin and A.B. Hoffman who managed to convince John and Yoko to fly to the John Sinclair rally, which is in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and they fly up on the 9th of December for the rally on the 10th. And it's all the famous protest people are there. John meets Phil Oakes.
Yes, Phil Oakes is there.
He's a curious guy. Phil Oakes is the kind of guy who, needs a film festival documentary about him, where people are like, this guy that everyone's forgotten about had this extraordinary Zelig-like career where he's in and out of all of these hot topics. He's fraternizing with Dylan and John and Yoko, and has a very sad ending.
Very sad ending. But he is incredibly influential in the early 60s in particular. So he's a peer of Dylan back then. And, Dylan at one point says, "I just can't keep up with Phil. He just keeps getting better and better and better." By 1966, when Dylan has gone electric, Oakes criticizes one of us must know, sooner or later one of us must know, and Dylan physically throws him out of a limousine saying, "You're not a folk singer, you're a journalist." And ouch. The irony, that is exactly, you're just a journalist. That's exactly the criticism that was leveled at Lennon for some time in New York City. Yeah. This isn't music, this isn't pop music, this is just journalism. But anyway, they get together and there is a recording of a song called Chords of Fame, performed by Phil Oakes for John Lennon. And there's some talk about this and chatting beforehand. And they start talking about, you know, how you can lift melodies from folk music and, you know, it's constant. And you think, John is intrigued by this. And you think, you're not intrigued by this. You've just done this with Stewball, and it's racing up the charts. You know,
it's a very sweet kind of conversation. Again, like all these things, it's on YouTube where John is kind of probing Phil Oakes for, oh, what you do and how does the Tradar form work and how many verses should I write? Oh, I see. And Phil Oakes is kind of generously explaining what's, you know, how you just take from one generation of songs and pass it on to the next generation of songs. And John is kind of taking it all in before Phil Oakes does this song, Chords of Fame, for John, performs that for John.
Yes, and you mentioned that sort of Phil Oakes did, you know, had a sort of a tragic end to his life. He's sort of more like Joan Baez, I suppose. He's like that sort of permanently an activist, and he doesn't sort of move away from that style. In 1973... he organises a concert to raise awareness about the Allende government in Chile. And Dylan comes along and performs at that. So you've got Pete Seeger, Arlo Guthrie, Dave Van Ronk. Dylan comes on board because the tickets aren't selling and Dylan is the draw. They discuss the possibility of going on tour together. Nothing happens, but that leads to the Rolling Thunder review.
Yes.
And one of the sort of interesting little postscripts is, you know, the Vietnam War officially ends April 30th, 1975. Oakes plans a rally in Central Park in May of that year called War is Over. But that's John's slogan.
Phrase, yeah.
You know, it's in Central Park. Who turns up for this? Harry Belafonte, Odetta, Pete Seeger, Paul Simon, Joan Baez. No John Lennon.
Yeah. He was around.
They're using his slogan. It's literally at the end of the garden of the Dakota. There's 100,000 people there. He cannot have been unaware of this. This is April, May 1975. He's not started learning how to bake bread yet. He could easily have, but interestingly, it's pre the granting of the green card. So
yes,
he's not going to...
And he's not going to rock the boat. Yeah. And you could argue Yoko is pregnant and he is starting his hibernation at around this time. Yes, and sadly, Phil Oakes in 1976 was diagnosed as bipolar and died by suicide later that year. It's an extraordinary life. And again, somebody who I think is worthy of a bit more attention because it's a fascinating story. Getting back to the rally itself... who's there? John and Yoko are there, Stevie Wonder, Phil Oakes, as you said, Bob Seger, Allen Ginsberg, he's everywhere. And also David Peel, who we'll come back to in a few minutes. There's no beginning to his talents, David Peel. And John and Yoko perform four songs, and if anybody kind of needed a bit of a light shone on where John and Yoko's heads were at 3 months after the release of the Imagine album, what songs do they perform?
They perform Attica State about a prison riot, mm-hmm. The Luck of the Irish about The Luck of the Irish, Sisters Oh Sisters, mm-hmm. a feminist song, and John Sinclair about John Sinclair.
And John apparently announces, "We're playing acoustic tonight. You might call us the Quarrymen." That's very nice.
That's lovely. And I think that means that officially, in addition to all, you know, Colin Hanson, et cetera, Yoko.
Yoko is one of the Quarrymen.
Yoko was a Quarryman.
That is, I'd never thought of it that way before. That's canon. There's a short film made called 10 for 2. after the rally. So it was filmed. Mm. And there is an effect because 3 days after the rally, John Sinclair walks free from prison.
Yes. Yes. They let him out. And the Michigan Supreme Court ruled that the state's marijuana laws were unconstitutional. And even today, they have a pro-legalization hash bash rally. We should do that.
And nobody ever went to prison for marijuana again, and we never needed to hear the song John Sinclair ever again.
It was except wonderful. We did. Except we don't. Yes, this is interesting because it was a very specific protest song. And by the time he's doing it in the studio, John Sinclair is out. You know, all is well with the world. And
But you can't throw away a good tune, you know.
You can't throw away a good tune. And it has a little bit of an afterlife because I know people like the legal stuff. The United States versus the U.S. District Court. In 1972, yes. On appeal to the Supreme Court, the court rendered a decision as if this was necessary, saying, we will prohibit the US government's use of domestic electronic surveillance without a warrant and let John Sinclair and his co-defendants officially off the hook.
Well, that's more innocent times when you weren't allowed to electronically surveil your population.
And,
you know?
Of course, electronic surveillance, again,
went away and never
went
came
away
back.
And never came yes. back. Disappeared throughout the land. So
So there's petrol in John and Yoko's tank right now for the next phase John and Yoko experiment. So on the 16th of December, just a few days after the John Sinclair rally on the 10th, John and Yoko, along with David Peel, appear on David Frost's US talk show. And this is a fascinating piece of television. If people haven't seen it, again, the whole thing is up there. You know where to look. And if there was ever to be a Sometime in New York City box set, you would hope that they might be able to even include the video of this hour long of television. And it is fascinating for a number of reasons. One is it's a type of television show you don't really see anymore. Certainly long form contentious debate these days. If you want to find it, you'll find it in whatever corner of the internet you've been algorithmed to get to. Whereas something mainstream like this is very striking. But let's start with David Peel and how awful he is.
He is your favourite, you know, possibly second only to Shanana in your hierarchy of great, great early 70s bands. Yes, David Peel has had a record career for some years before he appears on the Frost Show. So in 1968, he's contracted by Elektra. To be fair, in 1968, I think Elektra were signing everybody.
Anyone. You know,
we could have got a record deal in 1968.
I think so. Spoken word albums.
So his album, Have a Marijuana, peaked at 186 on the Billboard chart. And he is sort of rediscovered by John Lennon. And you can see that John just thinks he is one of those fascinating, amusing New York, you know, counterculture types. And you get a sense that he's almost, you know, the jester in the court of John and Yoko at this time. But anyway, John produces an album for Apple. It's only released on Apple in the US called The Pope Smokes Dope Every Day.
Mm.
I think the Pope he was talking to is no longer with us, so that's probably we can say that.
Yeah.
Now I have to use this point in the podcast to correct something I said on a different podcast.
Because
I said on the Is It Rolling Bob podcast, very good podcast, go and listen to that, but not my episode.
Yes.
I said that John Lennon never met Bob Dylan post that sort of Tittenhurst post Isle of Wight. But that is not true. Bob Dylan turns up at the David Peel sessions. Doesn't contribute. And the other thing was, but John did go to see Dylan and the band in 1974. So I'd like to apologise to all of the people who listen to
Rolling
Is It Rolling Bob? And, you know, they've been forwarding the hate mail and I can only apologise.
We'll have to recall that episode because, I mean, if there's any group of fans who have their sleeves rolled up more than Beatle fans, it's Bob fans.
You're absolutely right. I don't want to get on the wrong side of the Bobcats.
Oh, God, no.
Yeah.
The Bobcats. So if you're watching the David Frost show on the 16th of December, 1971, You know, David Frost in his, I still can't help but think of Eric Idle every time I see David Frost doing his unctuous presentation thing. But he's like, we've got a great show for you today. John and Yoko are here, David Peel. And everyone's like, who? What? And, you know, and some great controversy in chat. So they come out and the show starts. And the first thing that people see is basically David Peel doing the Ballad of New York, this song, with John and Yoko in the background. John head down a bit on a kind of a T-chest bass, and Yoko on a bongo, and David Peel, who looks like a sort of a hippie Donald Fagen character, but whose voice only a mother could love, as he sort of drawls this very dull diatribe about New York, and he mentions John and Yoko, and the camera cuts to John and Yoko, and the audience goes hooray, and you're like, what is happening here?
It's skiffle. It's John.
It is a form of skiffle.
John, you know, 10 years after the 14 years after the event, John is introducing skiffle to America, you know, playing his T-chest bass and what have you. But it's shockingly bad. And it is difficult to see what John sees in this. You know, I think he just thinks he's amusing. And it's just an indulgence. And John's got a record label, so...
Yeah, it's... I mean, if I'm not trying to get into a John and Paul divide here, but, you know, musically, something like getting involved with David Peel doesn't really have a musical quality that is worthy of, you know, the art form, I suppose. So it seems that John is putting the message ahead of the music per se, that the people he's surrounding with and the things he's trying to say, which I'm not saying there isn't validity to some of them or all of them, but that is taking front and center, as opposed to saying, I'm also going to do it by working with the best musicians or the best singers and players. That's not the case. Whereas, you know, somebody like David Peel, if they were in Paul's orbit, Paul would have been like, yeah, thanks. Okay, bye.
Yeah.
You can't carry a tune.
I think it's an element of this idea that John has and that Yoko sort of encourages, that, you know, the artist is the art, and that you don't have to have training, you don't have to be able to sing, you don't have to be able to paint, that everything that everybody does is equally valid. And that informs so much of what John and Yoko have been doing, you know, in terms of documenting their life, and every little thing that they do is art and is worthy of attention. And it's almost easy sort of directing that to somebody else. Well, look, here is somebody that has no talent, that has no voice, has no musical ability, but hey, you know, he's on the David Frost program, and he's got John Lennon as his bass player. So you could be like this too, guys, if you con John Lennon into giving you a record deal.
And throughout the hour of the show, they play the same four songs that they sang at the John Sinclair rally. By the way, we should point out, this show doesn't go out live. It doesn't go out actually until a month later in January 72. But Attica State, Look at the Irish Sisters, Oh Sisters, and John Sinclair. Now, when they sing Attica State up front, they kind of come to the front of the stage, the apron of the stage. They sing this song, and at the end of it, there's a cohort of the audience who are quite vexed that, yes, John has sung a song seemingly only having sympathy for prisoners. And, you know, there's a lady and a gentleman in the audience who come down the front and are like, you know, they were in prison for a reason, and, you know, you can't. And John is trying to say, no, I'm apologising for the prisoners and the prison guards and all the people who died in the Attica State riot. And there's this kind of back and forth, and John is in his full-on belligerent mode. Yoko's a bit more conciliatory. But again, you're watching this going, you know, in what kind of universe is a pop star in 2022 having an argument about a prison riot with
her? Yeah, I'd like to see Lewis Capaldi come on and discuss heated issues of the day. You know, but this is how I say, you don't get that. Like I say, Lewis Capaldi, I just happened to switch on the television last night and he was on the Jonathan Ross show. And I thought, it's just a celebrity love-in. No offense to Lewis Capaldi.
I mean, yeah, don't get me started. Anyway, but no, it obviously feeds to the time where the rock stars had something to say. Whereas nowadays, I guess you could argue we have, you know, the technocrats are the people who are putting out tweets that are trying to shift the geopolitical debate. Perhaps, I don't want to go all you know, Joe Rogan here. Nothing is real.
John takes this very badly. You know, he does not he gets really angry. He does not like being challenged like this. He does not like being misunderstood as he sees it.
I mean, there are some of these arguments that he is making that are carried through to the modern day. And certainly at that point in time, in the early 70s, and I'm speaking in very general political terms, there had been a shift towards jail time. There'd been in the 1960s, there'd been a dismantling of kind of federal mental health care. And so the prison populations had grown in the early 70s. They've certainly grown a lot more in the US in the intervening 50 years. So he was trying to get on board with the point of trying to say that prison isn't always the best place for all people. I think that's generally what he was trying to say, that, you know, we need to look at rehabilitation, and why would you put someone like John Sinclair in next door to somebody who's been, you know, a mass murderer? And, you know, there is an argument and a discussion to be had there, but it basically turned into a shouting match. And yeah, John kind of starts to withdraw from the show.
Yes. So the second half, he's disappears. He's sort of, Yoko is just sort of left to field the questions.
Well, she's the sole interviewer for the back end of the show with David Frost. And Frost, obviously thinking on his feet, is kind of giving a very reasonable conciliatory interview to Yoko.
But it's very strange. And it's very telling about John's personality that when challenged in that way, he just, you know, if you don't understand him, the reason why you don't like my music is you don't understand it. You know, it's that teenage, you know, you just, and it's a very adolescent response for someone who is projecting himself. You know, he was the man of the decade. He was the spokesman for the peace movement. And then he just, this very slightly petulant response, and then he won't come out at the end for the final bow either.
Yes,
you know, but he's talking about things in a very sort of febrile atmosphere. The Attica State Riot, and we maybe come on to that when we talk about the song.
Yep.
was incredibly emotive, and it was a raw topic, and he's addressing it in quite a clumsy way, and you know it's a clumsy thing that you're doing if it cannot be understood. If your purpose cannot be understood, then you should realize you're not articulating this with sufficient nuance or sophistication.
I think nuance is the word, and that's perhaps, you know, the problem that you run up against with when you listen to Sometime in New York City from start to finish, is that there's no space for discussion or to try and bring people around. And John kind of falls back on this thing, well, you know, I'm just a reporter, man. I'm just telling you the news kind of thing. And you're like, I don't think you're unbiased. And I don't think, you know, there might be an agenda here. But, you know, this is the sea he has chosen to swim in at this point in time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You've either got faith or you've got unbelief, and there ain't no neutral ground.
Ooh, heavy.
Bob Dylan said that.
Oh, anyway, sorry. Okay. I thought you were thinking.
You think I was thinking of my feet there? No.
It's like, whoa. They still have one more benefit in them before the end of the year. The following day after recording David Frost, they are at the Apollo Theatre doing a benefit for families and victims of the Attica prison riot. And they do acoustic versions of Imagine, Attica State, and Sisters O'. Sisters, and some of the usual people are around, Jerry Rubin and Bobby Seale, but also Chuck Berry is there, which
Chuck Berry is there. Yeah, that'd be good. John will always say, and Yoko will say, you know, how warmly received they were at the Apollo Theatre in Harlem, because, you know, most of the victims of the Attica State riot are black, and, you know, they're aligning.
Yeah.
But the thing is, they are aligning themselves very publicly here with Bobby Seale, Black Panthers, Jerry Rubin. All of these people are on Richard Nixon's master list of enemies of the people. So and so they're very upfront and very publicly aligning with a certain section of political opinion.
And it's worth keeping in mind the whole reason why they went to the US, because the next day they fly to Texas for a custody hearing with Tony Cox, Yoko's first husband, and he ends up in jail.
So the backstory to this is that they had previously, early in December, they went to Texas to meet with Tony Cox, who at that point was sort of part of a sort of Christian cult organization. there's a meeting arranged. He refuses to turn up unless he has his minister, his reverend, with him. They decline to meet him in those terms. They go back to New York. They issue proceedings. A warrant is issued against Tony Cox for not producing Kyoko. Sort of, I suppose it's in the nature of a contempt of court. He gets jailed for 5 days. His lawyer gets him out after 24 hours. Go lawyers. Cox then flees with Kyoko. And so this is 18th of December 1971. And Yoko will next see her daughter in 1997.
It's very sad and shocking. And we know now that Sean Lennon and Kyoko have a good relationship, and they've posted pictures of themselves hanging out on social media. But yeah, I think the plight of Yoko and Kyoko is something that's often overlooked in the Ballad of Yoko, and it's a very sad, horrible story.
I think so. It is overlooked, and I think we touched on this before. It's the parallels between John's life at this point and Paul's life. So they both are marrying divorcees who have a child of around the same age. So their lives are moving in parallel. But Paul settles down into happy domesticity with Linda, with her daughter. They have a child. You know, John and Yoko can't have children. There are miscarriages. Her child is effectively kidnapped and disappeared and out of her life for 2 decades. It's if those things hadn't happened, if they had got custody and physical custody of Kyoko, if Yoko had had the baby, carried that child to full term, how different would things have been, you know? But yeah, it is a tragic story.
And that brings us to the end of 1971. John and Yoko have been in New York for 4 months. They have gotten a lot done. They have plotted a course for what they are going to do next. And in the background of all of this, the Imagine album is kind of bouncing around the charts, selling tens of thousands of copies, which we, you know, amusingly, you know, you'd think anybody doing talk shows at that time would be promoting their new album. It's just left to its own devices to fend for itself in the background. Like, it doesn't even get a look in.
He's moved on.
He has moved on already.
And again, that's characteristic, I suppose, of the Beatles as well. You know, you record something and then, you know, from the first single, they put the first single out and they're already thinking about Please Please Me. That he's done Imagine and he's off. He's moved on.
Yeah, it is a very Beatles way of working. On to the next thing, on to the next thing, all the time. So the end of the year is when people take a pause, and that's where we're going to take a pause in this look at John and Yoko spending some time in New York City. The story continues in our next episode. But don't forget, we are available in all the usual places. NothingIsRealPod.com is the website, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group, at Beatles Pod on Twitter. We want to thank everybody for supporting us on Acast Plus for all the exclusive hidden episodes that exist over there. And for now, my name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we'll see you next time for some time in New York City on Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. And if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.